Greetings, fellow humans, and welcome to another episode of Off Grid with me, Dave.
And me, Lloyd.
Yes, it's the Not Really About Crosswords podcast. We've crossed swords with a crossword, crossed off the words we saw and got cross and swore at the ones we didn't, and we've each jotted down one of the words we came across for something to talk about.
This time, we've looked at Bobcat's puzzle from the FT, number 17669, on the 1st of March 2024. You don't need to know anything about cryptics to follow along with our chat today, but if you want to avoid spoilers to the puzzle, pause us and go and check it out now. Link in the blog.
Are you back yet? Well, we'll also have a short quiz inspired by the puzzle, and for that we'll naturally require general knowledge. So, General, are you there and how are you?
Hello, I'm great and looking forward to it.
Jolly good.
We're also each going to pick one favourite clue from the puzzle and explain how that works to you. Let's have the first of those favourite clues now, Dave.
Right, my choice was 22 across, which said, insensitive time-wasting demands to strike, which gives you a seven-letter answer. You can have a think about that, and I'll give the answer in passing after we've heard from the General. What did you pluck from the grid for us this time?
I was drawn to 26 down, which is Psalm. And Psalm makes me think of Psalm 119. You don't really have to need to know what Psalm 119 it's about. It's the one that starts, blessed are those whose ways are blameless, and it goes on and on about the same thing. But what's interesting about it is that it has 22 stanzas in it, 8 verses, 176 lines, and the 22 stanzas is significant because that is the number of letters in the Hebrew alphabet. And each verse within each stanza starts with the same letter, one letter for each stanza in order. So you've got 8 verses starting with Aleph, 8 verses starting with Beth, and so on. Okay. It's an acrostic. And it is, as far as we know, it's the earliest written acrostic. It's about 500 BCE. Nobody's sure exactly when these things were written. But you're talking about right back in the times when the classical Greeks were writing. And this was going on the other side of the Mediterranean.
Oh, wow.
Cool.
And what's the difference between a verse and a stanza? Because I vaguely assumed they were interchangeable.
Well,
but obviously not.
I think in Psalms, a stanza is what most of us would call a verse, and a verse is what most of us would call a line. So the only way I can...
Verses, yeah, in the Bible kind of verses, it's got its own specific usage, isn't it? Yeah.
And a verse is like a very long line, isn't it? And that's... Okay. I think that's about it. And maybe they don't like to call it a line because it tends to go over two or three lines of writing. So a line would be confusing if you called a verse a line a verse.
Fair enough.
So I started thinking about acrostics and when they have been used and when they've been more or less popular. Mm-hmm. And actually, they've always been quite popular. I think we like messing around with words. And once you've got anything which puts words in order, we tend to find some significance in the start of those words. So you've got the very famous acrostic for the fish symbol that the second century Christians started using in Rome, the symbol of Ichthus. So it's Jesus Christ, Son of God, the Saviour in Greek. Ah. We don't really know whether that was a secret symbol. We assume that the very early Christians were pretty much a secret sect. I think probably the Romans caught on to the fact that they were writing fish everywhere and probably knew what it was about. And then this whole thing re-emerged in medieval and Renaissance writing. People started using it as a form of steganography, so concealing messages, but in plain sight. So unlike cryptography, which makes it impossible to read the message, anybody could read a message in steganography if they only knew it was there.
Yeah.
So, the ancient Greeks, they had steganography, but they didn't have paper writing. So they would do things like hiding a message inside a dead dog, or they would have, use the wood panels that you create wax writing tablets out of. And you would, this is great, you carve your secret message into the wood tablet, then you cover it with wax and you write your shopping list or whatever you like in the wax, nobody knows there's a secret message underneath. You get, as long as the person you're writing to knows what you're about, they scrape off the wax, read the message. And that was
going quite a few messages retrieved from wax tablets where someone just has a heavy hand, as it were, of the handwriting in the wax, and has gone through and scratched the back, and modern scientific techniques have managed to read the scratching.
Oh,
and so you get
two messages for the price of one, obviously.
Yeah,
that's a sort of palimpsest.
Palimpsest, another great word.
You said Greeks didn't have paper writing. This is surprising to me.
I might be coming on to that later.
Okay.
To continue. Right.
Yes.
So this had been going on since the half a millennium before the turn of our numbering system. And it keeps going on into medieval writing. You've got people, Francesco Colonna produced one of the very first printed books. It's a kind of weird dream sequence books. And the first letters of each chapter, the big illustrated ones, which you think would not be too indistinct. People would notice what you're doing. They basically spell out Francesco Colonna really fancies Polly.
I'm guessing you're paraphrasing.
Very slightly.
Wasn't there a famous thing that I think James May from Top Gear in his early work was on the typesetting and layout of some motoring magazine, let's say What Car or whatever it was, and he did that with drop caps at the start of articles, and he spelled out some insulting thing about the editor, and somebody spotted it and he got fired.
I hope so. My girlfriend in my 20s was the sub-editor at a very serious arts magazine. Mm-hmm. And the first six editions that she published, the drop cap on page one spelt out her name.
Very good.
She left before they fired her. So. Now, what about the National Anthem of the Netherlands?
What about the National Anthem of the Netherlands?
It's the oldest national anthem around. Well, it's the oldest one that's still in use.
Right.
It's been going on since at least the 1570s. It has 15 verses. So if you think our national anthem is tedious, I can't imagine. I mean, it's a nicer tune. I'll give it. We have to accept this.
Most of them are nicer tunes than ours.
The Netherlands one is a nicer tune.
It's a great tune. And
okay.
The great thing about it is the first letters of each verse spell out Willem van Nassau. So they spell out William of Orange. Ah. And there's an English translation. Well, there are two English translations. There's an official one which spells out William of Nassau, and there's an unofficial one or an old one which spells out William of Orange, keeping the same sense but the same first letters.
So when you said the Dutch national anthem, I fleetingly thought, now is there going to be some strange way in which the Dutch national anthem is God Save the King because of William of Orange coming over here, but a different anthem you're talking about?
Some okay. people would say, obviously. Then you've got, who else you've got? You've got Lewis Carroll finishes off Through the Looking Glass with a 21-line poem. Each line starts with the letters of Alice Pleasance Liddell. A little bit creepy.
Mm. You mentioned Lewis Carroll's acrostics a few episodes ago, indeed.
And Nabokov, have you read The Vein Sisters?
No.
Lovely short story. Go away, read The Vein Sisters. I won't give too much away. It's about a haunting and it's got acrostics in it. And you've come to question whether the thing that's being haunted is a character in the story, the narrator of the story, or the printed page itself becomes haunted.
Oh.
Nice.
That sounds like the sort of thing that Italo Calvino would do as well. Yeah.
1958, same vintage. Hmm. And then, of course, the Victorians took all of this and turned it into a puzzle. And this was, you know, one of the very important precursors of the crossword. Mm. So we're back where we started. But I wanted to leave you with one of my favourite acrostics, and this is John Laird McCaffery. John Laird McCaffery died in 1995. He has a headstone in a Montreal cemetery. And the headstone was commissioned jointly by his widow and his former mistress, mm-hmm. and they used it to tell the world what they thought of him. So
yeah.
I'm just going to read it. You can keep track of the first letters of the lines and work out for yourself.
Okay.
free your body and soul. Unfold your powerful wings.
Oh, yes.
Climb up the highest mountains. Kick your feet up in the air. You may now live forever or return to this earth unless you feel good where you are.
Very nice.
Well, that is...
John Laird McCaffrey, yes. 1995.
Popular fellow, obviously.
If you were just strolling around in that particular graveyard and happened to wander across it and notice it, you'd think it was his own choice to have put it there.
You might, no. Yeah.
It's quite subtle. It's on the back of the gravestone. People go looking for it. I didn't believe it the first time I saw it. It was a Photoshop gag. If you Google it, you'll find dozens of people who've gone out to look for it and taken their own photographs.
It, yeah.
So you know, it's a rudest gravestone in the world, unofficially.
Cool. Dave, do you want to explain how your favourite clue works for us, please?
Sure. If you remember, it was insensitive, time-wasting demands to strike. Seven letters. So here, I think the best way in was to start thinking of demands to strike, which could be call-outs. And if that's wasting time, it's deleting the T, which, when you close up the word space as well, leaves you with callous, which is insensitive. I thought it was a nice, convincing, smooth surface on that one, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about your choice of clue, General?
I like the light, a simple one. It's number four down. It's a nine-letter word, and the clue is wagon being mostly converted to mobile home.
That's another nice surface. We'll have the answer to that coming up after Void's choice of word. What leapt out of the grid for you?
I wondered what five down Agnes would have to say for herself.
Agnes?
I think probably the first Agnes that we'll think of is Agnes Spadoni, right?
Yeah.
If you say so. I mean, Agnes Grey, perhaps? Yeah.
Well, Agnes Spadoni started her career in 1887 as an assistant to her brother, Paul Spadoni, who I'm sure I don't have to tell you, in a throwback to the previous episode, was, that's right, a strongman juggler.
Oh, yes, those Spadonis.
Oh, that Agnes.
Right.
Yeah, so she and I have that in common. Although Spadoni was Paul's stage name. So she may have been Agnes Krause, which is his original name. Sadly, I can't find any further details about her, either online or in my juggling history books. So I'm going to move on.
Talk about some other.
Yes. The second real Agnes I thought of was Agnes Moorhead. Does that name ring a bell?
She was in Bewitched, amongst other things. She was the mother.
That's the one. Yes. American actress, born 1900. She studied for a BA in biology and was a teacher for a few years before moving on to get an MA and a postgrad, before starting her acting career in radio. And it wasn't until 1937 that things started to take off for her, really, when she had joined the Mercury Players. And Dave gives us a slight nod there. Soon after this, she got a role in a film that was directed by that troupe's leader. Now, I wonder if either of you know his name or the 1940 film in question.
Is it Orson Welles?
Ding! It is Orson Welles.
In which case, this is either going to be Citizen Kane or Magnificent Ambersons. Probably Kane, I would imagine.
It was Citizen Kane. She played Citizen Kane's mother, Charles Foster Kane's mother.
Right.
Although she was also in The Magnificent Ambersons.
Oh, well, there you go.
Directed by Welles, for which she got an Oscar nomination and won the New York Film Critics Award for Best Actress. I first remember, though, as you say, for being in Bewitched, the US sitcom, which ran from 1964 to 72, and she played the mother-in-law of the main character, Samantha. Do you remember her name?
I was trying to remember it. Is it something like Endora or something like that?
It's something very much like that. Okay. Yes, she played a witch. Apparently, she wasn't all that fond of the show, She said that some of the scripts were hack writing.
Well, but, I suppose it's a come down from working with Wells, isn't it?
Well, maybe a bit. I do think it's the thing she's most remembered for, or best remembered for now, because Bewitched got syndicated a lot and it's been rerun quite a lot. And it had a remake.
Entertained film. Us all as children. Do you know how they did the famous nose-twitching gag?
Oh, no, I don't.
Ah, well.
I think the actress could actually just do that, couldn't she?
No, they had a large piece of glass which they pressed up against her nose and they wiggled the glass.
Wow.
Fantastic.
And that's how TV special effects used to work.
Special effects for you.
For computers.
That's just a brilliant. Listener, just take a moment to picture that. Hold up your own pane of glass in front of your face. Just press it lightly against the tip of your nose.
And waggle
quickly
it.
Wiggle it from side to side. Oh, that's fantastic. I love that. Yes, even though she wasn't that fond of the show, she got a couple of Golden Globe Best Supporting Actress awards for it and a Primetime Emmy as well. Another one of her roles was in Lucille Fletcher's 1943 radio play, Sorry, Wrong Number, which was essentially a single hander for Agnes. Okay. It later entered the National Library of Congress National Sound Registry as being culturally significant. And it won an Edgar Award from the Mystery Writers of America. And also, it was described as the greatest single radio script ever written by someone we've already mentioned, Orson Welles, again.
Oh, okay.
He gets around. Incidentally, Louise Fletcher's then-husband wrote the score to Citizen Kane and The Magnificent Ambersons and Jane Eyre, all featuring Agnes Moorehead. And so I suspect someone is now going to be able to tell us his name.
Well, it's a name that the Americans pronounce differently than we do, but they call him Bernard Herrmann.
That's the fellow. Have you mentioned him before?
Entirely possible.
But yeah, Agnes had a long career, and I was looking through the titles of some of her films, and there were a few titles that I particularly liked. Our Vines Have Tender Grapes.
That's a melodramatic.
Adventures of Captain Fabian. And my favourite, Those Redheads from Seattle.
Yes.
About them, I know not what, but there they are. She was also in some classics. Jane Eyre, I already mentioned. Showboat and The Woman in White, an early version of that. And in a couple of horror films, The Bat with Vincent Price.
Oh, yes. With a nice rubber bat on a string.
That's the one, yes. And one of her later films, Dear Dead Delilah, a schlock horror film. I mean, have you really had a long acting career if you haven't appeared in a dodgy horror film? There were two of her films that caught my eye. 1973's Charlotte's Web, in which she voices the goose. And 1956's The Conqueror, starring John Wayne as anyone?
No, that one's passed me by.
Genghis Khan.
Ooh.
In an amazing bit of casting.
Yeah.
Adventurous.
Those two films, though, have something in common. Any idea what? Charlotte's Web and The Conqueror. You would have had to have seen them both to get this, to be fair to you. And you're not going to. But this is where we came in, because in Charlotte's Web, a rat juggles a very large number of pieces of fruit and catches them in his mouth.
Right.
And in The Conqueror, there are some scenes featuring some fire jugglers.
Oh.
One further notable but sad thing about The Conqueror is that of 220 cast and crew members, 91 of them had, by 1980, developed some form of cancer, and 46 of them died from it. Believed by many due to exposure to radioactive fallout from atom bomb tests in Utah, where the film was shot.
Lovely.
Downwind of. And indeed, sadly, Agnes Moorehead died of cancer in 1974. Although she was working almost right up to the end. But on a greater note, I think she was a great character actor across all genres. So Cheers, Agnes Moyd.
Well, there we go. General, how does that clue of yours work?
Well, this is one of those clues that you can learn how to do, so that if you're starting out with cryptic crosswords, you can give yourself a lead in. It was wagon being mostly converted to mobile home. So when you see a word like converted, you should be thinking anagram, because crossword setters like to convert one word into another. And when you are looking for an anagram, you next start to look for some letters in the clue which have the right number of letters to match up with the solution. Now, it just happens that wagon being has one too many letters in it. But then you notice that the word mostly tells you it's not going to be all the letters. So you take 9 letters out of wagon being, and wagon bin turns out to be an anagram of Winnebago. Nice and simple, very sweet. And I just like the idea that Winnebago is very nearly an anagram of being wagon.
Mm.
Yeah. Winnebago being a brand name of mobile homes, in case anyone was unaware.
Other mobile homes are available.
Void, what was your choice of clue out of that grid?
I picked one across raw new soldiers fighting for the experience of a lifetime. That's 5-9.
Yeah.
Dave, what have you picked out of the grid?
Well, see, mention about the Greeks and their paper, or what they did or didn't have, is apposite, because one of the answers was papyrus, which was the answer to 25 across. I don't know about you guys, but this brings to my mind two separate things. So which would you rather hear about, a writing material or a typeface? or you could have both if time allows.
You choose.
All right. For this little bit, I'm indebted to Keith Houston's marvellous book, The Book, which talks about papyrus in its very opening chapter. Okay, so what is it? It's a sedge. That is to say, it's a tall, grass-like reed. Cyperus papyrus. It's native to Africa. It grows in shallow water, and it has stems of a triangular cross-section. Yes, it is etymologically the source of our word paper.
Mm-hmm.
But the ancient Egyptians used it for a lot more than that, largely because it was so abundant. This is going to sound a lot like a list of a hitchhiker's uses for a towel, but here goes. the reeds, when dried out, they're about 4 times more buoyant than balsa, so they made boats with it. Some translations of the Old Testament have Moses' basket made of papyrus rather than usual bulrushes.
Right.
You can peel the green skin off it and plait them to make strong, light cords, or weave whole stems together to make ropes up to 3 inches in diameter. Herodotus claimed that the Egyptians would roast and eat the lowest parts of the stem, although modern tests show that it's low in calories and nutrients, perhaps good for dietary fibre.
But is it tasty?
Well, I can imagine that famous line by Paul Hogan, was it in Crocodile Dundee? You can eat it, but it tastes like shit. It was inevitably used in various medicinal applications. You could bundle the reeds to make a mattress, weave the skins into a blanket, and so on. One of the Egyptian gods, the god of the annual flooding of the Nile, entertainingly named Happy, spelled H-A-P-I, he's commonly depicted with papyrus reeds growing out the top of his head.
Is that the crocodile god? Is that Happy or is that a different one?
I don't think so, no.
Okay.
Anyway, but as a writing material, yeah, it's reckoned to date to around the end of the 4th millennium BCE or slightly before. So then you get at least 3 millennia of its use by the Egyptians and then the Greeks and the Romans as well, before we get anybody writing a description, or at least one that's come down to us, of how it's made as a writing material.
Mm.
When we do get some sort of description eventually, it's fairly rudimentary and slightly confusing, because it's from everybody's favourite famously reliable Roman writer, Pliny. So, at any rate, you make thin strips from that triangular cross-section, either by just slicing them or by slicing most of the way through and then rotating it and slicing again and rotating it and then unrolling what you've cut.
Okay.
But the point is, once you've got a flat sheet, you lay all these bits lengthwise on the table and you trim off the ends, and then you lay a second layer on top at right angles to it, and you kind of laminate them together. And Pliny says you soak them in Nile water, and that's what laminates them together. But again, modern tests show that two layers pressed together, they'll bind quite happily and permanently with or without the water, and it's probably just the sap of the plant alone that is enough to do the trick.
So is it two separate layers at right angles to each other, or are they interwoven?
Separate layers.
Yeah, okay. You're making plywood.
Yeah, essentially.
Right.
But the Nile water is rich in clay and aluminium sulfate, which are used as size and to change the absorbency of papers, even up until quite recently, to help them take ink better.
Right.
So while Pliny didn't quite get the purpose right, he wasn't entirely wrong. That's what I've got on papyrus as a writing material, but you have some fun with the typeface as well. It's it's often derided as the second most hated in the world after
Comic Sans.
Yeah. And part of the problem with them both, perhaps, is that they were created for very specific niche usages, and then they got bundled with computer operating systems, whereupon everyday users, i.e. not design professionals, kind of leapt upon them because of their informal distinctness from all the staid official-looking types like Times and Helvetica and things that they'd had access to before.
I have to admit, I have used papyrus at some point a long time ago, though. And having done so, after some time passes, I started noticing it in other places.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, right, everyone uses this. Right, okay.
Well, its notoriety, I think, was boosted after its use in the film Avatar. And the subsequent Saturday Night Live skit featuring Ryan Gosling. Have either of you seen that?
No.
He plays a guy who has a breakdown obsessing over what a poor and lazy design choice it was for a multi-million dollar budgeted Hollywood movie. I'll find a link and we'll put it in the show notes and you can see that. But the story goes that the scriptwriters just used papyrus for the title on the front cover of the script. And when James Cameron got it, he just liked it more than any of the other options that were later offered to him by the art department.
And no one came along and said, you know, that's a hack choice, James.
Yeah, obviously not. Well, you know. The title, as used on the film, the movie posters and the other promotional stuff, isn't out of the box papyrus. It has been tweaked a bit and kind of adjusted. But the on-screen subtitles for when the Na'vi are speaking their own language, that is just system font papyrus. So, what's its story? It was designed in 1982 by a chap called Chris Costello, who was just out of college. He'd been studying the Bible and was trying to just imagine for himself what English language text might have looked like if it had been written in biblical times on papyrus.
Okay.
So he was sketching out loads of designs with a calligraphy pen on some textured paper. Now, at first, he just drew two sets of capitals, regular capitals and sort of oversized display ones to go with it, with kind of extra long, slightly swash parts to it.
Okay.
And he managed to sell the design to Letraset, famous makers of dry transfer lettering. They gave him 750 quid for it in 1983.
Which is £3.5 million.
In modern days, yeah, quite. I'm acutely aware that we'll probably have a generation of younger listeners out there who have never used or even seen a sheet of Letraset.
Mm-hmm. Dave, hold some up to the camera in the audio podcast.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, in fact, I mean, all the sheets that I've still got left, none of them are actually by Letraset. They're all third-party jobbies like W.H. Smith ones and whatever, but there we are. Anyway, when Letraset bought the design, they insisted on having a lowercase too, so he had to go back and design that after the fact. So that's possibly the first of the design compromises. He drew the lowercase quite some time after the caps and at someone else's behest.
Okay.
You fast forward to 1991, Microsoft released Publisher, and they'd licensed a bunch of fonts off of people like Letraset. So this is the first time it is bringing down desktop publishing out of the world of professional designers who would be using things like PageMaker and Quark Express into the hands of everyday office users for making, you know, newsletters and things like that.
Come to think of it, I think it was Publisher in which I used Papyrus.
Well, there we are. I mean, then you go to 1997, and they bundle it into the small business edition of MS Office, along with a load of clip art and lots of other fonts and things.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty soon after that, Papyrus is part of the suite of fonts supplied with any version of MS Office. So it's getting more and more ubiquitous. And in 2003, Apple added it to the suite of system fonts for their OS as well. But this is where it all goes a bit weird, because the version that Apple supplied paired the lowercase with the original regular capitals. The version that Microsoft supplied paired the lowercase with those oversized titling capitals, which have a different baseline, which were never supposed to go with the lowercase in the first place, because they were supposed to go with the regular capitals. So this means that Papyrus looks different on a Mac from on a PC, and the PC version kind of looks worse, especially in mixed case settings, because of the baseline bobbing up and down, because of the cap and the capitals looking too big. And neither platform really enables you to set the regular capitals with the titling capitals, which is how it was originally intended to be in the first place.
Right. So if you make a website and specify Papyrus in a PC, it won't look the same to a Mac user, and vice versa.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, those kind of problems are fading a little bit into the past now. Most websites are done using sort of Google Web fonts rather than system fonts.
I wonder what this episode's blog entry is going to look like.
Well, I was going to say, we promised not to set the show notes in Papyrus, but maybe we don't promise that. I don't know.
Maybe a little bit.
Anyway, give us the answer and the parsing of that clue you read out earlier.
Yes, it was raw new soldiers fighting for the experience of a lifetime, 5-9. The definition here was the experience of a lifetime, which means the rest of the clue was the wordplay, raw new soldiers fighting, with 4 being a link word, so wordplay for definition. Mm-hmm. And fighting here, we have another anagram indicator in the sense of struggling, inaction. So you're going to move a bunch of letters around. And oh, look, raw new soldiers is 14 letters. It's the required number of letters. So an anagram of raw new soldiers gives us a phrase that means the experience of a lifetime. But, and this is why I liked it, not in the sense of a dream holiday or my wedding day or something like that, but a rather more jaded view of the experience of a lifetime. And the answer is world weariness.
Yes, I thought that was a nice definition of that. Yeah.
I have some quiz questions for you.
Marvelous.
So now, Papyrus.
Yes.
Who won $700 for what in February this year?
Relating to Papyrus in some manner.
Certainly relating to Papyrus.
$700.
So, no. Okay. Sorry. $700,000. Who won $700,000?
Okay, that's somewhat different. Oh, I think I know.
I think you do.
Okay.
See, when I thought it was $700, I thought, well, that's just going to be some, I don't know, newspaper competition or school district prize or something, but $700,000.
Feels more like a legal payout.
It's a nice prize.
Oh, no, a prize.
It's a nice prize.
Yeah, it's a prize for reading some Papyrus.
Reading Papyrus. It was won by 3 people, an Egyptian PhD student, a SpaceX intern from Nebraska, and a Swiss robotics student. And they won the Vesuvius Challenge Grand Prize. And this is about a library of about 1,800 papyrus scrolls from a building in Herculaneum, one of the 2 cities that were destroyed by the eruption that destroyed Pompeii. And they were instantly turned into carbon. So you've basically got 1,800 thick sticks of charcoal. Yes. And the Victorians found them, tried to unroll them, found you just couldn't. You ended up with basically flakes of soot. And since people have been doing CT scans. They've been applying the ultra-high resolution CT scans to these things to the point where they can actually virtually unroll the entire scroll and produce what looks like a mottled black continuous film. And what these students have been doing is turning that into readable fonts by looking at tiny differences in the in phase disruption of the X-rays on the surface of the ink that's on the remains of the papyrus. And they're using AI to find patterns in there, trying different combinations of different AI systems so that they don't, the first one they try doesn't just give them something that sounds vaguely Greek and might fit. And they seem to have come up with something which works, and they've managed to get 5% of one scroll read. And they're going to carry on now and see if they can read a few more of them. And basically what they've got is an unknown treatise by an Epicurean philosopher, obviously around the turn of the millennium. It basically says, enjoy yourself. Do you have another question?
Go for it.
Yes, please.
Are you ready for a maths question? Of course you are. What's the world's oldest unsolved problem in maths?
Ooh.
Going back to exactly this sort of time.
It's going to be pretty old. Is it going to be something like the sphere packing problem?
That's a good one. That's not solved either, but, or at least it's solved. We all know what the most efficient way to pack spheres. It's just that no one can prove it, or at least not to the satisfaction of a mathematician.
Right, but just to the satisfaction of greengrocers.
Yeah, physicists all know it, mathematicians all believe it, but nobody can prove it.
Oh, okay.
It's about number theory.
Oh, so is it, would it be prime nine, prime numbers?
Primes come into it, primes do come into it. It's about perfect numbers. So a perfect number is one of the ones where you take the numbers that you could divide into it, add them up and get the same number. So 6 is 1 plus 2 plus 3. 28 is 1 plus 2 plus 4 plus 7 plus 14, all the numbers that could divide into it.
Okay.
And there's the first two perfect numbers. So Euclid knew about these, and this is 300 years BCE. He found a formula for them. This is great stuff. You know, he didn't just find them. He worked out that you could generate them by taking a number that's one less than a power of 2 and multiplying it by the next lower power of 2. And that gives you a perfect number as long as the first of those two things you're multiplying together is itself a prime number. And that's where primes come into it. So do some examples. It's much easier. 4 minus 1 times 2 is 6. 8 minus 1 times 4 is 28. 16 minus 1 times 8. Well, that doesn't work because 16 minus 1 isn't a prime number. It's 15. But then you keep going. 32 minus 1 times 16 is 496. That's a perfect number. 64 minus 1 doesn't work because 63 isn't prime. 128 minus 1 times 64 gives you 8,128. And those are the only four perfect numbers that the Greeks managed to find because it takes so long to prove that you've got a perfect number when you get there.
Because the bigger the number is, the more work you have to do to work out all of its factors. Yeah.
Just like trying to find prime numbers, it gets harder and harder the further you go.
So the computer revolution has enabled us to find numerous more.
We certainly have got further than that. And it got to the stage where we had got, by the 13th century, we'd got 7 of them. And that stage, we got up to 137 billion.
Wow.
So these things really take off.
That's pretty good work for the 13th century.
Yeah.
This was Ibn Fallas. They were the great Arabian
mathematicians.
Yeah. And Euler found the next one, not until 1732. That one is 2 to the 31 minus 1 times 2 to the 30, which is... I won't read out the whole thing, 2.3 quintillion.
Right.
So 2.3 with another 14 zeros on it. This is 18th century. He's not using computers. And that's about it. We got four more until computers came along. And then we started using computers on it from 1952. And we now know, well, guess how many perfect numbers we know.
So hang on, how many had we had?
We got it to 8 in 1732.
Okay, I think we've got 4 more.
Computers turn out to be a bit better than that. We've now got up to 51. That's as of 3 years ago, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. That is using that. This isn't even using one computer. This is using a crowd computing project where you volunteer your computer overnight. And if your computer happens to spot a perfect number, you get kudos for it. I mean,
oh, but not $700,000.
Sadly, no. But, you know, mathematicians will be really impressed. And the biggest one we got so far, 2 to the 82,589,933 minus 1 times 2 to the 82,589,932.
It's 2 to the 83 million or 82,000?
82,589,932. The number itself has 23 million digits. You can buy a book. It's like a very, very thick telephone directory with 5-point type all the way through it. But
I'm guessing that hasn't made the New York Times bestseller list yet.
Oh, the original version was number one in Amazon for 4 days.
In its specific category, though, I'm sure.
They sold all the copies they'd made by then. But here's the question. Nobody has ever... All of these numbers...
Didn't want to be the proofreader for that.
The question is, see, all of these numbers that are generated by that formula, they've all got powers of 2 in them, and that means they're all even numbers. In fact, specifically, they all go something ending in 6s and 8s. But just the fact that you've got a formula which reliably generates even numbers doesn't prove that's the only
way. Yeah. Exactly. So is that puzzle that's unsolved the puzzle of whether or not
there is
a way to produce an odd one?
Yeah, we've got up to 2 to the 82 million, and we haven't found one yet. Is there one out there? No, nobody knows. It's very, very, very unlikely, but nobody knows.
I don't think I'll be betting a large amount on an odd one being found.
But the great thing about this is by people obsessing about this kind of stuff and looking for them on computers, this has... pushed forward research into prime numbers and found new prime numbers that people would never have bothered looking for. And prime numbers, of course, are the basis of modern public key cryptography, which is the replacement for all the ancient steganography we were talking about earlier.
Ah, yes.
Oh, fundamental interconnectedness is good, isn't it?
Do we have just a little bit of time for some probability? Now we're into maths mode. Do you know the Monty Hall problem?
Yes.
Yes.
It's a goat.
Two goats in a car. You're in a game show. Let's make a deal. You get to a certain stage and you're given three doors. One door has a car behind it. The other two doors have a goat. And you want to win the car. And...
I've got a car. I want a goat.
Yeah. <you know. laughs> The way it works is you get to choose one of the three doors. Whichever one you choose, Monty Hall, the presenter of the show, opens one of the other doors and shows you there's a goat behind it. So you've now got two doors left and you're given one last choice. Do you want to stick with your original choice of door or do you change to the other door? So the question is, should you stick or change and does it matter?
Yes. So the common sense approach would be...
The intuitive wrong one.
Yes, that's the phrase.
That is the way it makes no difference at all, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you would think it would make no difference at all because you think, well, I've already made my pick. They haven't moved where the car is, so it's not going to make any difference.
And you also think, well, out of what's left, there is one door with a car and one door with a goat. It's 50-50, and I've either picked the right one or I've picked the wrong one.
Mm. Well, you see, Dave, you have got the common sense approach, which is what 85% of people not only guess, but will stick by, even after you've given them the correct explanation, because it's so obviously right. This became notorious because it got into the Ask Marilyn.
I was going to say Colin. Marilyn Vos something.
Von Savant, the highest ever IQ score in the Guinness Book of World Records.
Yes. Yeah, and she was the first one who kind of said, no, hang on a minute, that's not the right answer, wasn't she?
She wasn't quite the first one, but she was the first one to publicise it
in
a general interest publication. And she got 10,000 replies telling her she was wrong.
Yeah.
Including allegedly 1,000 of those were from college PhDs in maths. So it is really, really easy to give the wrong answer. But Void, you actually had, although you say you had the common sense approach, you had the beginnings of the right answer, which is that you chose a door which was a 1 in 3 chance and the car will not have moved. So however else you justify it, your choice is a 1 in 3 chance. It can't suddenly become a 1 in 2 chance just because somebody's waved around a piece of door somewhere else. That doesn't make cars move around. So if your choice is 1 in 3 and there's only one other choice, the other choice must be a 2 in 3 chance of being a car. So
a 1 in 2 chance?
A 2 in 3 chance. Because
Before you've seen the goat.
Because right, Well, no, it's before you saw the goat, each door has a 1 in 3 chance.
Right.
You choose one, it's got a 1 in 3 chance. That is never going to change. It's still a 1 in 3 chance. If you were a physicist, it would be a wave function, and there is a 1/3 probability of, like the cat in the box, it's got a 1/3 chance of being alive.
Schrodinger's goat, yes.
Schrodinger's goat, yeah. I put it back in now. So, well, you first choose a door, it's got a 1 in 3 chance of having a car. That's never going to change. The car isn't going to move. The other two doors, as far as you know, each have a 1 in 3 chance. As soon as Monty Hall rules one out, then he is putting all the chances of all the other chances of the car into one place. So all the other 2/3 chances go behind that remaining door. So that remaining door has a 2/3 chance of a car behind it. So if you want to change, it's 2 to 1. You'll have the car. Stay where you are.
See, now
you're going to lose it.
I've heard about this before. I've had it explained to me before.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's made sense to me before. And I feel like I've gone, right, okay, that's the reason why you should change. But it's only when you just say there that the remaining 2/3 choices are all transferred to the other door.
They've got
to
be somewhere.
That it really hits home as to now, why that makes sense.
Most people will want to see a computer simulation before they believe it. Mm-hmm. And basically because our minds are screwed up and we cannot deal with probability.
That's good. That really nails it down for me. Thanks. Was that all part of question 2?
That was question 3.
That was question 3.
That was question 3.
You have successfully navigated the quiz.
Hooray.
Okay, you have been listening to Off Grid. Please subscribe via whatever system you're using to get your podcasts. Leave us a rating and a review if you would be so kind. Show notes are, as always, at offgrid.tlmb.net in whatever font we choose to set them. And you can say hi to us on socials, where I'm at Skoingle.
And I'm at The Void TLMB. Do make a post about Off Grid online somewhere. If you like it, hashtag OffGridPod and stick the URL in there. Maybe someone seeing you post about it will make them more likely to give it a listen. And seeing us post about it again. Anyway, General, what would you like to recommend for the listener this time around?
Oh, I don't know. You might want to go and look at boatmancryptics.co.uk. And if you're using the medium formerly known as Twitter, you might like to look for at Boatman Cryptics.
I believe he has a new book out with a bunch of new cryptic crosswords.
Strange you should mention that. There are now two whole books, which were, I can reveal exclusively, they were made in Publisher.
Hey! Listener, they are not set in papyrus.
Brilliant. We'll be sure to check all of that out. Thank you, General, for your expertise once more.
A pleasure.
We'll see you all next time, folks. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.
Off Grid is a TLMB production. Thank you to Bobcat and the Financial Times for the crossword. Our theme tune by The Trudy has escaped from the Phantom Zone. Find out more at their Bandcamp. If you enjoy this podcast, please let someone else who you think would enjoy it too know about it. Thank you. See you next time.
My experience of Canadians is they really, really like a belly laugh.